Hi, I'm Danielle Kading, and you're listening to Hear Me Out on Wisconsin Public Radio. In our first half hour, we're going to be talking about local food systems in northern Wisconsin and efforts to connect growers to consumers through community-supported agriculture. In the second half hour, we'll take a look at Enbridge Energy's request to renew a permit so the company can continue to operate and maintain its Line 5 pipeline in the Shawamigan-Nicolet National Forest. But up first, we hear from Chris Duke with Great Oak Farm in Mason. The farm is one of about 20 in northern Wisconsin that are members of the Bayfield Foods Cooperative. Together, they make up the growers who provide local food through the Lake Superior CSA. I spoke with Chris this week about the cooperative CSA and his farm.
Great Oak Farm, we're a 60-acre farm located down in Mason, about 15 minutes south of Ashland here. And we grow mostly vegetables. We do about 10 acres of vegetables, organic, certified organic vegetables. And we also have a flock of grass-fed sheep. So we had about 100 lambs this spring. And so we've got all those woolly buggers and their moms running around in the field now. So it's pretty cute.
Okay. So when you're selling stuff to the local area, are you doing it mostly through the CSA, or how does it work for you?
Yeah, so for us, it mostly is CSA. We do about 70% of our produce goes out to CSA, and then about 30% wholesale. But about half of that wholesale goes to Spirit Creek Farm for processing vegetables. So tons of cabbage and carrots and green beans that go to make lacto-fermented dilly beans or kraut or kimchi, whatever they're processing. So, and then the other half of that wholesale goes to local restaurants. Freehands Lakeside buys a lot of stuff, and local like Sixth Street Market or the Shawamigan Food Co-op. Those are kind of our main, you know, there's a handful of folks. The Deepwater has changed their menu around, actually, and is going to feature a lot of local stuff now. So they've been getting some weekly orders. So, yeah, that's pretty cool.
Yeah. So how long have you been farming then?
Yes. Yeah, so 2009 was kind of the time where we went from, like, grow food mostly for ourselves and sell the leftovers to grow food mostly for sale and eat the leftovers. So 2009 was kind of like the first year that we started really growing for sale, for wholesale. Before then, it was kind of like set up at farmers market and, you know, a little bit to the food co-op here and there. But we just didn't have any kind of a volume till then. Yeah, so since about 2009. And it started off using draft horses as our source of power, which was a lot of fun. But as we have grown into more and more space, a pair of draft horses keeping up with 10 acres of vegetables is a pretty tough order. So, yeah, this is year three with tractors. And as much as I love working with the horses, I wouldn't go back. The tractors are pretty amazing. It almost feels like you're cheating. You know, you get so much done so fast. But, yeah, it's been a fun transition, you know, from smaller scale to size, you know, scaling up to be able to feed more people. And I feel like that's what I set out to do, is try and feed people in our region. So it feels good to be getting there.
And so when you first started out, did you see a lot of support for it, or how, you know, can you describe to me the challenges of getting into the local market?
Sure. Yeah, I think we're really lucky up here that there is a lot of interest in local food, and people really go out of their way to support local producers, whether not just fresh produce, but meat and, you know, anything. Normally they say like about 1% of a population is going to be looking for local food and excited about a CSA. And I feel like in our region, we're a lot further ahead of that. It seems like people are pretty excited about, CSA and local food. And, we actually, you know, people from across the country and across the state too, look up here and see what we've got going on with local food and are pretty impressed. We just had some folks from Maine that came out to the farm a couple weeks ago, and they were really excited, you know, especially with our growing climate is not like what, you know, you would think of as ideal. Our soils aren't like rich black dirt like Iowa, you know, it's kind of like clay or sand. And we definitely have a lot of challenges. There's not a giant market. You know, we're surrounded by woods to the south and water to the north. So not a whole lot of people. But the folks that are here are excited and ready to try local food. So that's been exciting. We started off packing about 60 CSA boxes of vegetables every week. And so this year we're packing about 150. So yeah, it's growing. It grows every year. And that's been really exciting. And we've worked hard to sort of listen to what kind of things people want in their boxes and what veggies they're excited about and what ones they're less excited about and, you know, quantities and that sort of thing. And I think the biggest thing to sort of make sure that people stay excited is to keep quality high and just do the very best we can with you know, the growing conditions and everything that we have. But, yeah, since the food is getting picked yesterday and it should be, you know, to them, to our CSA members by this evening, I mean, that's like as fresh as you can get, really, unless you came to the farm and picked it yourself. So,
well, can you explain the economics of it? Because, you know, my dad was a farmer, mm-hmm. and he was a traditional farmer, so the cost of production, it was always hard to keep up with the equipment and all of that stuff.
Sure.
And make enough to make ends meet.
Right.
How are you doing that? I mean, is it because I know some farmers work off the farm and then mm-hmm. farm at the same time. How does it work for you?
Right. So I'm on the farm full time, and my wife works off farm. So that way we've got a nice balance of reliable income and, you know, health insurance, retirement, that sort of thing, to sort of even out the ebbs and flows of the crop cycle. But and I think a lot of farmers are, you know, going that direction now, where there is some off-farm income in their household and some on-farm income in their household. And that sort of just reflects the, I think, the feeling that your dad probably had of, you know, a lot of times agriculture can be sort of boom and bust, particularly with commodity agriculture. It can be a hard game to play. Now, the nice thing about like a CSA style where we're selling directly to the people who are going to eat it is there's nobody in the middle. So it doesn't get marked up a whole lot. And as a grower, you're getting a better price than if you were selling at wholesale. And as a CSA member or customer, you're getting a better price than if you were to buy it all individually at a grocery store. Right. So that way, kind of everybody wins. And I think staying out of that whole big picture commodity market where the price fluctuations go up and down all the time, you know, even within a series of months, you know, the price will go down or up. This way we can sort of agree on a price and set the price, and then we know if we sell X number of shares what our income will look like for the year. So as far as cash flow planning and budgeting and that sort of thing, when we sit down with a pencil or on the computer, we've got some real numbers to look at. And agriculture in general, I mean, it's a pretty unforgiving and variable, you know, occupation. And so when you can iron out some of those wrinkles and make it a little more predictable, that really, I think, makes all the difference, you know.
So what has been some of the things that have been most challenging about connecting to local markets and making a living off of that?
Yeah, great question. I think the most challenging thing is getting the word out to people that, like, what a CSA is. I mean, CSA has been around since the 90s. It's been around for a long time, but it is still sort of a fringe thing, you know. Not as many people get a CSA. I mean, really, like 99% of us, we get our groceries at the grocery store. So that's where most people are looking for food. And so to go outside of that model is, you know, it's like trying something new. It's, you know, it's not what you're used to. And so, and it takes an extra trip to stop by your drop site and pick up your box, but it's pretty darn convenient too in a lot of ways, because then if you are willing to be flexible about what you're having for dinner or lunch, or, you know, what vegetables are in your fridge, but you're looking for what's fresh and what's local, it's covered. You stop by, takes 2 minutes to pick up your box, put it in your car, and you're on the way home. You didn't have to stop at the grocery store and hunt around and wait in line and that sort of thing. So there's benefits to it too. And I think just sort of teaching people or helping people learn, sort of thinking outside the box in a lot of ways. And another tricky thing with particularly fresh vegetable production on the marketing end is cooking, that we are cooking a lot less than we used to as a nation. And last year was the first year ever that Americans spent more eating out than they did at the grocery store. So we've sort of seen this line creeping up where people are eating out more and buying less ingredients. And so I think, you know, that's something that's on our radar too, is how do we make sure that if people are buying fresh ingredients from us in the CSA box, how do we support them so that they know what to do with them? You know, if they have been cooking less, it may seem intimidating to get a box full of, you know, vegetables when, you know, most Americans don't eat near enough vegetables to begin with.
Right.
So we have a newsletter, and in the newsletter there's recipes that our CSA manager staff puts in there based on what's in the box to help people kind of get some ideas about preparation techniques, and storage techniques is another thing. And then we also have a Facebook discussion group for our CSA members that they can share ideas about like maybe successful meal preparation or, you know, dinners that were really a hit with their family that they made using the ingredients in the box, to sort of pass the word to other CSA members that, you know, give them some good ideas.
And try to meet that desire for convenience.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. And I think, you know, as we have developed, this is year, goodness, five, I think, of our CSA. And as we've gone along, we've sort of tweaked what's in the boxes every year. And we do a couple surveys every year to our CSA members to ask them, what'd you think? You know, was it too much, not enough, just right, of each of the vegetables? And so we really take that feedback to heart. And if people aren't excited about it, even if we're excited about growing it, if they're not excited about eating it, then we start, you know, cutting it down and making sure that things are in there, that things that they're looking for. And I think a lot of people buy a CSA because they know they should eat more vegetables, and they know they should, they want to eat healthier, and they want to eat fresh stuff. And so sometimes having things that need to be prepared, you know, that goes back to that challenge of cooking, and we're cooking less, and just sort of familiarity of cooking with greens, for instance, or that sort of thing. So any chance we get, we try and put in as much fresh stuff as we can. Cucumbers, carrots, cherry tomatoes, snap peas, all those things that you can just eat on the bag, you know, on the way home. You can pass them to the kids in the back and they'll eat the bag on the way home. So those things people are really excited about. Common foods that, you know, broccoli, things like that. People are really excited about broccoli. And we've also tried to keep products in there that if they're feeling overwhelmed and have too many veggies in their fridge, that they can blanch and just put them in the freezer. So then they've got, you know, say there's too much broccoli came this week, or they're, you know, gone, the kids are at camp, or they're, you know, out of town. They can just, you know, just take 10 minutes and cut that broccoli up, blanch it, put it in the freezer. Whereas if you have like a whole bunch of lettuce or other things that maybe don't freeze as good, then you're kind of on a timeline where you got to eat it by a certain, you know, by the end of the week. So we've been pretty conscious about whenever possible to keep as much of what they want in the box.
So, you know, as people want to know more about where their food is coming from, local food has grown, or the interest in it, but are you able to make money off of it? Like, are you able to sustain a living just by selling to local markets?
Right. Well, that was sort of the short answer is no, because the local market defined as sort of the Ashland, Shawmigan Bay region. And the short answer is no. So some years ago, some of us growers got together and we were like, okay, how do we work together to get outside of our local market and look at sort of the more regional market of Duluth Superior, and how can we work together to sort of help each other out and get into these markets instead of each of us trying to do it on our own, which is, you know, I mean, you spend all day growing stuff, and then when do you have time to get all that marketing done and the delivery and have the refrigerated transportation infrastructure and all that sort of thing? So that's sort of the how the Bayfield Foods Cooperative got started. We sat down and scratched our heads, and there's about 20 different farms that are in our cooperative. And so our Bayfield Foods Cooperative, it runs this Lake Superior CSA, which is direct to, vegetables and produce, fruits, meats, even some value-added stuff in boxes going directly to people. And then we also have a wholesale program, and we use the same infrastructure, the van and the trailer if we need it. And we do a wholesale delivery route over to Duluth Superior. We have one locally, and we also do one down Highway 51, 53. And so that way, it's awesome because there's not 20 different farms that need to have 20 different vans and 20 different drivers driving the same route, you know, all the covering, you know, redundancy. We have, we can drop all of our stuff off here. One person, the delivery driver, takes everybody's stuff out. And it doesn't matter if, like, if I just had a couple cases of green beans or a few cases of cucumbers, well, that doesn't make it worth driving to Duluth Superior. But I've got a couple cases of stuff. Another grower's got a couple cases of stuff. There's a pallet of apples. There's, you know, all these things start adding up. And then it's totally worth taking the time to take the drive. So that has been, I think, really a huge part in pushing a lot of our cooperative members' farms to a successful, sustainable place. So some of the farms are, I mean, we've got everything from, like, you know, fourth generation beef farms to Bodine's Fishery. I mean, they've been a staple name around here for generations, all the way to people like me. I mean, that the first generation farmer that built the farm from scratch, and even even smaller growers who they don't want to have a full-time farm, but they really love growing some good food, kind of market garden style, and setting up at the farmer's market doesn't always work out. You know, sometimes it rains and nobody shows up, or I think a lot of times, you know, young families, when you are first farming, setting up at farmer's market's no big deal. You're like, well, Saturday's just another day, you know. But once kids come into the picture and you know, your sort of life changes, those Saturdays are kind of important, you know, to spend with the family. And so this way, even those growers have an opportunity to sell stuff and get their Saturdays free. So there's kind of a quality of life increase that happens there too. The other tricky part about farmers market, which I do miss, it was a ton of fun when we were selling there. But I mean, if you want to sell, you know, $1,000 or $2,000 worth of stuff at farmers market, then that means you need to show up with $1,000 or $2,000 worth of stuff. And if people don't come, or if it was a rainy day or whatever, then that means you're going home with $1,000 or $2,000 worth of stuff. So that's kind of heartbreaking. And this way, through a CSA and a wholesale program where we can coordinate with our wholesale buyers and know ahead of time what they're looking for before we even plant. You know, if they're like, yeah, we want 50 pounds of cucumbers a week, we're like, okay, great, we can plan for that. And we can also take sort of, we call them opportunity buys. If we have like an extra case of cucumbers, we'll throw it out there for our wholesale buyers, and you know, they usually snap it up.
So basically, by pooling the resources with all the other farmers in the area, it makes more economic sense. It
makes a ton more economic sense. Yeah. Yep. And it really streamlines that process of getting food out to people. And that's kind of the crux. I mean, a lot of times we think of growing food is really challenging, and it is. It is challenging. And but you know, we can, you can get some tricks up your sleeve to sort of mitigate that risk. And you can have irrigation, and you can have mechanical weed control, and you know, you can have even some mechanical harvest aids. But getting that food out to people, that's the hardest part. And so this way, by working together and forming this cooperative, we have really ironed that part out and got a really good system now.
Can you support yourself fully off of the CSA?
Right. So for us, it's been, yeah, that our sort of ratio of about 70% CSA and 30% wholesale, I feel like is starting to be a good level of economic support and household income kind of a thing. And I mean, anytime when you're starting off a business, you know, it's going to take some years before you hit that break even point. And, you know, then you're paying off these infrastructure investments and that sort of thing. So I think, you know, any farm that starts off is going to be in those shoes for a while. But yeah, just I think knowing that the produce is sold ahead of time is just a huge weight off. You know, there's not like, okay, we have 400 pounds of broccoli that's ready this week and it looks like 600 pounds next week. Where is it all going to go? You know, it's you know where most of it's going already. So that is, I mean, really helps you sleep at night, and I think takes away a lot of the worries that a lot of traditional farmers face, where your crop is getting ready for harvest. You look at the price. The price is low because everybody else is getting ready to harvest. And you're like, oh, no. You know, what do I do? I've got to pay off these operating loans. I've got, you know, I'd like to make an income. You know, I've got whatever bills to pay. And so, yeah, just knowing that it's sold ahead of time has been huge.
But what about, you know, in the cases where, like, it's been a really wet year.
Mm-hmm.
So what if, you know, you have a crop that fails and you've already committed to selling such and such to your
right.
CSA members?
Yeah, great question. So one of the awesome things about CSA is that it is pretty flexible what's in the box, right? So this year, so typically we have tomatoes by now. Everybody's getting a pint of cherry tomatoes and a big slice of tomato for BLT. This year, it's been so cold and wet, our tomatoes are just kicking in now. Now, that said, we have had tomatoes in the boxes for a couple weeks now, which is pretty exciting. But anytime things are low, say it's not such a good year for tomatoes. Tomatoes are a little slow. But it's a cool, wet year. The broccoli is doing great. So you'll get less tomatoes in your box this week and more broccoli. You know, for instance, or say a year like this where it's cool and wet and everything's a little bit slow, we've also had extra greens being in the box this week, collard greens or kale or Swiss chard, that sort of thing, or this spring, to help, you know, provide some. There's still dinner, you know what I mean? As long as you're flexible about what the vegetables are, that it's not sweet corn and watermelon and tomatoes and green beans every time. So yeah, I think that sort of flexibility for the growers is really important to making sure that local produce farms can stay in the game, basically. Because you're right, if you have a wholesale buyer and they're like, okay, we want you know, a pallet of tomatoes every week, and your tomatoes are 3 weeks late because it's cold out, that means you just lost 3 weeks of income. And that's really tough to climb out of, you know, early in the season. The other nice thing about this CSA is it's not just me. It's not just Great Oak Farm. There's four other vegetable producers who are member producers and grow vegetables for the boxes. So say it was really wet at my place down by Mason, but it wasn't quite as wet up by Washburn, and John's on sand. So his carrots are coming in a little sooner than mine. So that way we can get carrots, you know, from him instead of from me in the box 1 week. So we sort of geographically, all our producers are located in Ashland Bayfield counties, but there's all these little microclimates in the counties, and we each have, you know, different tricks up our sleeve to sort of extend the season and mitigate that risk. And so another thing that that we use extensively is hoop house structures, like little unheated greenhouses, and that makes a huge difference. The field crops were really dragging this year because it was so wet and cold. But anything we planted in the hoop house or even in our heated greenhouse, I mean, it was doing fantastic. So, you know, those sorts of things help spread out that sort of cool weather or frost, even, you know, that sort of those risks.
So basically, by working together as a community, it helps everyone to succeed.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And I mean, this is something like I feel like I probably could run a CSA just with my farm. I don't want to, because it's been awesome working with these other guys and having a CSA manager who can coordinate with CSA members. You know, I'm busy in the field all the time, and for me to come in at night and then have to, you know, talk to deal CSA members' questions or print up newsletters and that sort of thing. I mean, that way we can do what we do best, which is grow food, and our CSA manager Steph can make sure that the wheels are running smooth, you know. So I think it definitely helps everybody out.
Thanks, Chris.
Yeah, thanks, Danielle.
Again, that was Chris Duke with Great Oak Farm in Mason. Stephanie Jager is the manager of the Lake Superior CSA. I rode along with her on Wednesday as she was delivering CSA boxes to their members.
So where are we headed?
We are going to Washburn, and then we are going up to Bayfields, and then back to Ashland.
What are we delivering today?
We are delivering vegetable boxes and South Shore meat boxes, fruit boxes, and flower bouquets.
And you do this every Wednesday?
Yes.
So you deliver straight to the customers?
Yeah, so we have what we call drop site hosts. And so they agree to let us drop off CSA share boxes there, and then customers come and pick them up between, you know, typically between like 4 and 6 p.m. Something we've added this year, though, is employee drop sites. So the city of Duluth, St. Louis County, and the city of Ashland have all, and UWS have all signed on for employee drop sites. So if you're an employee of those places, then we'll deliver CSA shares to you. Oops.
So how did the delivery program come about with the cities and with UW Superior?
Well, it started out as just a CSA committee discussion one night, just how we can reach you know, groups of people in one place, so just to kind of make our marketing a little bit easier. And so, you know, we'd read in other CSA blogs and listened to some podcasts that was something that CSAs were going after, just targeting those groups of people that might be interested. So it was just kind of finding the wellness director of UWS to start with, and she was all about it. I'm pretty sure that the city of Duluth contacted me about having, like, their wellness coordinator contacted us to set up CSA delivery. So we actually started that in July of last year. So this is the first full season that we're doing it, and it's a huge success. We have probably 30 people that pick up there just, you know, at city of Duluth for their employees there. So it's a good start.
Do you feel like you're seeing a lot more interest right now in CSA delivery and things like that?
Yeah, I mean, if we were looking at our sales numbers and our number of customers this year versus the last couple years, we probably have about a 20% increase over last year's numbers. So I would equate that to be an increase in interest. I think the wellness coordinators, I think that's a new thing for them, so I'm seeing a little bit more interest from those types of people. So yeah.
So you think it's like the wellness programs with the cities or at these institutions that is kind of driving that growth?
Yeah, for that particular sector of our CSA shares, yeah.
Anything else that you think is driving that increase that you're seeing?
Oh, I think people just, you know, are pretty disgusted with the food system and Monsanto and, you know, just all the chemicals that make it into our food system, and really kind of looking at other options. And I think CSAs and co-ops expanding all over the state are making it a lot more accessible for people. And we also, you know, we offer payment plans, which, you know, in the past a lot of CSAs weren't able to do, so we're trying to make it more affordable for people. to purchase local and to eat local. Do a 2-month down payment for people, and then I can set up monthly payment plans, and, you know, it's just like taking it out of your grocery budget. It's pretty cool.
So what are you hoping to see for the future of the Lake Superior CSA?
Well, we're, you know, always looking to expand and sell more shares, which only helps our farmers. So we applied for a buy local grant, and we did receive it. And so our plan is to launch a shipping program so we can ship our South Shore meat shares along with some other things, and eventually do like a local meal kit, being able to ship vegetables. So that's something we're currently working on. So that would definitely be something in the future that we would like to do.
How big a deal is the shipping portion of it? Because right now it's basically the delivering, so this would allow you to change that how?
Yeah, so it would actually just be an additional program. We would keep the CSA the same, and then in addition, we would just create an additional program to be able to ship things to people, which we currently don't have the option to do. So just looking at additional ways to make it more convenient for customers to get local food.
So would that be kind of like the things that we're seeing with, I think Amazon is starting one, I forget the other one.
Yeah, I mean, there's Blue Apron, you know, Farm Direct, there's a lot of HelloFresh, there's a lot of these subscription services that you're seeing pop up. You know, the advantage we have is that we can actually still offer local food because we would keep it all within our cooperative. You know, Blue Apron, those types of services typically aren't local. At least in my experience in researching them, they're not local. There's a lot of packaging that goes involved with them.
So how far would you be able to ship them? Would you still keep it to the local area, or would you be going further?
Yeah, we'd be able to ship in Minnesota and Wisconsin to start out with, because that's where we can do one-day shipping. So we're looking to do just overnight shipping.
So when you drop off boxes for the customers, what are some of the things that you usually hear from them?
I usually hear that they really, really love getting fresh local produce every week. A typical response is that it's like Christmas every week, and they just really like, you know, having different variety of things that maybe they wouldn't have bought themselves. So just, you know, a learning experience, and, you know, cooking, learning what eating seasonally even looks like. You know, we've gotten pretty accustomed to just going to the grocery store and buying whatever we want, whenever we want. So this is a good lesson also, you know, to see what stuff is grown in what months. You know, you can't get tomatoes in May typically, you know, so it's a good learning experience for people as well.
That was Stephanie Jagger with the Lake Superior CSA. You can find out more on their website at bayfieldfoods.org. We're going to take a short break, but when we come back, we'll hear about Enbridge Energy's request to renew a permit to maintain its Line 5 pipeline in the Shawamigan-Nicolet National Forest. I'm Danielle Kading, and you're listening to Hear Me Out on Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, I'm Danielle Kading, and you're listening to Hear Me Out on Wisconsin Public Radio. Enbridge Energy's Line 5 pipeline crosses around a dozen miles of the Shawamigan-Nicolet National Forest in northern Wisconsin. The pipeline has been operated and maintained there since the 50s. Now, Enbridge is seeking renewal of a special use permit to continue maintenance of the line on forest lands near Washburn. The Forest Service held an informational meeting last night in Ashland about the permit with Enbridge and the Pipeline and Hazardous Materials Safety Administration, or PHMSA. I spoke with Forest Supervisor Paul Strong about the permit.
It's a permit that allows the existing pipeline to continue to be there and operate. And as most people know, if you were to drive out there, you wouldn't see a pipeline. What you would see is a mowed area, perhaps around 50 yards wide, and that pipeline is buried beneath the soil. It's been there since 1953. And you'll see a pumping station here and there, which moves the oil that's passing through there along. There are a number of different kinds of special uses that are allowed on the National Forest. And if we decide to provide folks a permit for those, it comes with terms and conditions in the permit. And so the permit holder is responsible for meeting the terms and conditions. We're responsible for oversight and compliance with those terms and conditions. But that's about how the land is treated where the pipeline is. It's not about the regulation of what's going on with what's going through the pipeline. That's PHMSA's job.
Well, has the Forest Service had any questions or concerns over the years as to how Enbridge has been operating the pipeline on forest land?
Yeah, I would say for the most part, no. I've been here 7 years. There's no real big issues. Like anything else where you have a disturbed area, generally there are things that need to be done, heavy rainfall, severe erosion, a pretty normal interaction between us and the permit holder.
What are some of the questions that you're getting from the public?
A lot of the questions are around the history, quite frankly, and what roles different entities play in the management of the pipeline. Some questions and concerns about the safety of it, you know, those sort of questions. We have had some questions about the impacts of having the pipeline there and having this, it's roughly around 70 acres that are affected by this when you do the length and width and, you know, what values aren't being realized that if you managed it in a different way.
Well, and I guess that's kind of what I was wondering is just what are the impacts to the wildlife, to the land, to the forest? Is it significant?
Yeah. In the big picture, out of the 1.5 million acres of national forest land, that amount of acreage is pretty insignificant. It's a linear strip of unforested land that's actually really great habitat for some kinds of wildlife. Lots of different pollinators using the grasses, the forbs, the shrubs that grow there. Lots of different kinds of songbirds that would prefer that kind of habitat versus a forested habitat. You know, grazing animals, rabbits, deer, those sort of animals that prefer those openings in the forest. So, and then there's that suite of species that will never use the pipeline because they like deep forest conditions. But again, it's a relatively small amount of acreage in a pretty big national forest that's mostly forested.
So what do you want the public to know then as you're considering this permit and reviewing it?
Well, we want them to, A, know history accurately, B, to understand the Forest Service's part of this process, which is not comprehensive, it's not everything, because our greatest desire holistically in all of this is to have a well-informed public that can provide as thoughtful a comments as they can as we do the environmental compliance and eventual decision-making on the permit.
So this is the only stretch of land that goes through the forest, of the pipeline that goes
right.
through the forest.
In Wisconsin, yes. On the Shawamigan-Nicolet, it's the only stretch.
Okay. So what are some of the questions that you've had then for the other agencies, like, you know, or company, Enbridge and PHMSA, you know, as you've gone through this?
Well, you know, again, historical records have been important. Understanding what roles they play in this. For the most part, having a pipeline on your property that's operating effectively doesn't take much of your attention. And this renewal process has allowed us to have contemporary relationships with the people at Enbridge and with PHMSA and learn a little bit more about what roles they play and how they coordinate.
So what is the timeline for considering all of these details and then making a decision?
There's not a fixed timeline on this. We're going to continue to collect comments, provide answers to questions as we get them. Through the summer, it's possible that sometime this fall a decision will be rendered, but it's not absolute. So when we feel like we've gotten people information they need, that we've gotten the vast majority of comments that we're going to get, and we go back and do the analysis of what we feel we need to do, then a decision will be rendered.
So what would happen if the Forest Service decided not to authorize a permit?
I don't know if I can answer that question for you. Accurately. I'm not the decision maker in this, and when we have existing permits, it's very different than having somebody apply for a new permit where, you know, something hasn't happened out on the ground. So I'm not sure I know how to answer that directly.
So who is the final decision maker?
It's actually the person who's my supervisor. Our regional forester is the name of the position. She's out of our regional office in Milwaukee.
So, but if it is approved, then everything is kind of status quo?
Well, again, the terms and conditions of the permit could change. And, you know, if so, there might be something that we need to do a little bit differently to make sure that the effects of the pipeline are appropriate for the land it occupies.
Currently, when Enbridge makes requests to maintain Line 5 on forest lands, there's a number of things that have to take place.
They submit to us in writing along with a map, and we run it through our environmental analysis folks.
That's John McNeil with the Forest Service.
So they'll say we need to dig this section of the pipeline up, and then they'll tell us how they're going to access it, what equipment they're going to use, and when they'd like to do it. And then we run that through our cultural folks, our biologists, hydrologists, all those folks to make sure that, they're not breaking any laws and that, they can do what they need to do.
So it takes a lot of work for them to get in to do the work that they need to do.
Well, I mean, it's maintenance work, so obviously we want the pipeline to be well-maintained, so we try to expedite it whenever possible. So usually a few weeks it might take us to review their request and get them an approval letter back, and then we'll send them something in writing that says, hey, thanks for submitting your maintenance request. You're approved to do X, Y, and Z, whatever they ask to do. And we might put some mitigations in there, right? So avoid this sensitive site or use mats in the wetland. We always inspect folks' equipment to make sure that it's free of soil and plant parts because we don't want invasives out there, and then also that it's just generally serviceable, not leaking diesel, hydraulic fluid, that kind of thing.
So there are some requirements that they have to fulfill if they want to be able to go and make some changes or do any maintenance.
Well, so that's two different things, right? So maintenance of their existing pipeline is one thing. If they wanted to change the facilities that they have out there, then we would do new NEPA. We would do new environmental analysis.
But Enbridge spokeswoman Jennifer Smith says they're not making any changes to Line 5. She says they're just attempting to renew the permit.
It's basically just continued authorization to continue to operate the line that's been operating there for decades.
Say you needed to go and maintain the line, like something you just wanted to check on how it was operating. What would that entail?
Sure. So the permits themselves, we can access the right of way. So if we just wanted to go and do a visual inspection, you know, we can just go ahead and go out there and walk. But we run inline inspection tools through all of our pipelines. And anytime those tools that run through the pipelines, they can pick up if there's been a nick in the steel or if there's been a scratch in the coating. All of our steel pipelines have a coating on them that protects them from the environment. We may need to send a crew in there to actually dig up that area of pipe and do more visual and non-destructive testing and really take a look at what was that anomaly that tool picked up. And so anytime we would need to do like ground disturbance work, different things like that, would definitely, we'd have to notify the National Forest Service, and they have, you know, requirements for information and different things like that.
So when this line was built, you said it was built in 1953.
Mm-hmm.
So what is the typical lifespan of a pipeline?
Well, you know, and actually a well-built and well-maintained pipeline can be used indefinitely. We call it fit for service. And so there are a number of different factors that go in to that. And it's, you know, what was the thickness of the steel or the steel that was used at the time of construction? What is the coating? There are different types of coatings. And through the years, there's always a new technology, a new, you know, next best thing. And here's state-of-the-art technology. But actually, we found on our pipelines in similar age of Line 5 is that old coating that, you know, or not the old coating, but the coating that was used at the time of construction has been very stable, and it really protects the steel. Like I've heard from some of our crews, when you know have to go in, if you have to take a look at the pipe, they will maybe, you know, need to remove some of that coating, and the pipe looks like brand new. And then just from our inline inspection tools, they continue to show us that this pipe is fit for service, it's in great condition. And so there are a number of different factors, and each pipeline is kind of its own based on when it was built, where it's at, the environment that it's going through. Each one has kinds of its own features and maintenance requirements. But, in general, as long as a pipeline is well built and well maintained, it can be used indefinitely.
Whether it's Line 5 or Line 3, whatever line, that there's been a lot more attention and interest around it in recent years over how they're operated, how they're maintained. And what would happen if Enbridge were not to receive an authorization of this special use permit? What would that mean?
Well, I wouldn't want to speculate that. I honestly don't know what that answer is. I think that, again, we aren't asking for authorization to do anything new. And so, you know, I think that at least we're confident that we'll get this reauthorization. But I guess I'd just say that millions of people rely on the products that are transported on this line every single day. I mean, it's the crude oil going to refineries that's used for gas and jet fuel, diesel fuel, But this line also carries natural gas liquids, which get pulled off and are used for propane. I mean, we're heating people's homes, we're powering their grills. And so it's not as simple as just saying, okay, you need to turn this off, because it will affect millions of people's lives every single day.
In the cases where you've had to shut down service because you need to make a repair or whatever else happens, what do you do to make sure that the product gets to where it needs to go?
That's a good question, because we do shut down our lines to make repairs anytime if we're doing work at the terminal or if we have, you know, larger repairs out in the field. And those shutdowns, those prolonged shutdowns, they need to be coordinated with the end user, the end route. So the refineries, the shippers. I mean, it's a logistics system, and it's pretty much just in time. I mean, there isn't at the refineries, there isn't this huge backlog of crude oil that's just sitting there. So, we here in the United States use about 18 million barrels a day of crude oil, and that's every single day. So right now we are transitioning to renewable sources off of fossil fuels. Enbridge itself has invested over $7 billion in recent years in renewable energy sources, and that is a long-term strategy for the company, is diversifying our assets. We recently merged with Spectra Energy, which is a natural gas pipeline company, and so we've balanced out our portfolio between the crude oil lines and natural gas, which that's seen as a bridge to get us from fossil fuels into a cleaner source of energy. And so that is the long-term goal and range, and, you know, not only Enbridge, but everybody wants to move there, I believe. So at this point, until we get to that point in time when we're not using 18 million barrels of crude oil a day, these pipelines are the safest, cheapest, most economical way to move this type of product.
But others don't see it that way. Some people turned out to protest authorization of the permit, like Joe Bates. He's a Bad River tribal member who lives in Odena.
Well, I'm here tonight to oppose Line 5. I also support the resolution that the tribe did, asking for, or demanding, actually, that Enbridge decommission and remove Line 5 from the interior boundaries of the reservation.
So why do you want to see the Forest Service not authorize a new special use permit?
Well, that would have to go back to the age of this pipeline. This pipeline was constructed in 1953, back then it was said that the life expectancy of Line 5 is 50 years. So now we've exceeded that by 14 years, and the lease is up, and so it's, it's kind of like a landlord situation. The lease is up, and we opt to not renew the lease, so it's, pack up and get out.
So by not authorizing the permit, you hope that they will remove the pipeline from forest lands?
Yes, that would also be a good goal. I know it's going to cost them a hell of a lot of money in order to remove that pipeline, because they're going to have to clean it out also. But now Line 5 needs to go. Very, very little of it actually services anything here in the United States. I think there's some natural gas in the UP, but otherwise it's Canadian oil going to Sarnia, Canada, and that's it. It was built here just because it's the shortest way to Sarnia, Canada, Ontario, or wherever it is.
So you feel like there's no use for the line, and that it should just be deactivated or removed?
Right. If Canada wants their oil, then they should actually take their pipeline and reroute it north of the lake and go that route, even though keep it away from the lake. We still don't want an oil spill that's going to affect Lake Superior or any of the other Great Lakes.
Is that the primary concern, then, is the risk of a spill for you?
Absolutely. I mean, with the age of this pipe, right now Enbridge actually is seeking permission to come in and repair several anomalies on the reservation. So if that's just three or four within an 18-mile stretch, how many is there between Superior and Sarnia, Canada?
So doesn't that concern you then, that they can't go in to fix what they want to fix?
Of course it's concerning. You know, if they don't fix the anomaly, sooner or later it's going to leak. I mean, there's no ifs about it. It's just, it's a when. When is it going to leak? And that's the same thing for the pipeline that goes, the twin pipelines that go underneath the Straits of Mackinac.
So then I guess, are you hoping that by not authorizing it and by not granting them access, that they'll decide to shut it down because that'll be the most safe thing to do?
Yes, that would actually be one of our goals, is for them to shut it down, decommission it, and remove the line itself. Yes.
So how likely do you think it is that the permit will or will not be granted?
Well, that that would just be a guess on my part. But with the amount of people that we have up here that are very concerned about our water, they're going to have a hell of a fight on their hands.
What do you think will happen if they decide to authorize the permit?
It could come down to rubber bullets and LRADs and, paid militia.
So you're saying that people here would be willing to protest and prevent them from accessing the site?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Even go so far as to set up camps. We would have camps set up again. I mean, after all, they are in our ceded territory. So it's treaty territory. And we have unalienable rights that are protected by the federal government within the ceded territory.
Again, the Forest Service doesn't have a set timeline for making a decision on the permit, but you can find out more on their website at fs.usda.gov. You can also learn more about Enbridge's pipelines at enbridge.com. We're going to take a short break for these announcements. I'm Danielle Kading, and you're listening to Hear Me Out on Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, I'm Danielle Kading, and you've been listening to Hear Me Out on Wisconsin Public Radio. That's it for our program. You can hear it again online on our website at wpr.org/superior. You can also check us out on our Facebook page at facebook.com/KUWSFM, and you can check us out on iTunes under Hear Me Out. We hope to have you back with us again next Friday. Until then, have a great weekend.